Los Angeles would be right now burning to the ground, just like the houses burned to the ground.
He again chose escalation. He chose more force. He chose theatrics over public safety.
Protests erupt across the country over immigration raids and the call-up of U.S. troops to help police civilians. We explore the controversy with a Catholic priest from the Archdiocese of Los Angeles.
Just a wonderful thing that I've been allowed to see at my age, to see this now, is just heartwarming to me.
Young, old, and in between join together in celebration of the true presence of Christ in the Eucharist as the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage travels through the Lone Star State. It's a weekend to celebrate Pope Leo in Chicago. We'll tell you about the big event, plus get a sneak peek inside the Pope's childhood home, about to be sold at auction. And we take you to a Catholic middle school designed to help boys overcome educational challenges and set them on the road to academic success. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
We're united with parishes throughout the Archdiocese of Los Angeles in praying for peace in our streets and in our city.
The head of the Catholic Church in Los Angeles calls for calm as his city becomes the epicenter of protests against ICE raids targeting immigrants. Police are out in force to try to keep the peace, yet the Trump administration cites the unrest as a reason to deploy the California National Guard and active duty Marines based in California. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. President Trump's activation of nearly 5,000 military troops in Los Angeles 1 week ago has become a flashpoint in his larger battle to stamp out illegal immigration. That deployment has since sparked an unprecedented legal battle, instilled fears in the large immigrant population in Los Angeles, and fueled protests from coast to coast. From New York to Austin to San Francisco, protests have erupted across the country to decry President Donald Trump's intensified crackdown on illegal immigrants. Demonstrations began on Friday a week ago in downtown Los Angeles as immigrant enforcement sweeps began to ramp up in Southern California. Immigration and Customs Enforcement conducted a raid of a clothing factory in the Fashion District, detaining two dozen garment workers. Outside numerous Home Depot stores, authorities targeted day laborers in search of work. Immigrants have been targeted at car washes, on farmland, and inside federal buildings. The White House confirmed more than 300 people have been detained in these raids and says about a third of them had prior criminal convictions. Advocates for immigrants say most of those targeted are everyday workers trying to make ends meet for their families.
They are the essential workers. Let's not forget, when COVID-19 hit, who was the ones who did the job? The immigrant workers. And they pay a price.
Clusters of protests continued to grow downtown through the weekend. Last Sunday, tension reached a flashpoint as Trump deployed National Guard troops to L.A., and even more people came out to protest. Hundreds grew to thousands, many of them spilling out onto Highway 101, blocking traffic. Some set cars on fire and looted businesses.
When peaceful demonstrations devolve into acts of vandalism or violence, especially violence directed at innocent people, law enforcement officers, and others, we must respond firmly.
Officers attempted to control crowds with tear gas and non-lethal munitions. On Sunday, an officer intentionally targeted a reporter on the sidelines, shooting her with a rubber bullet.
You just shot the.
On Tuesday, LA Mayor Karen Bass instituted a curfew for certain areas of downtown. Trump openly criticized Democrats who lead the city and state, calling Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom incompetent on social media. The governor, the mayor, and police said President Trump's activation of more than 4,000 California National Guardsmen and 700 active duty Marines was not needed. A governor is typically responsible for deployment of a state's National Guard. Newsom called Trump's move purposefully inflammatory.
This brazen abuse of power by a sitting president inflamed a combustible situation, putting our people, our officers, and even our National Guard at risk. These are the men and women trained for foreign combat, not domestic law enforcement.
Because they are not trained for civilian crowd control, the troops had to receive hastily arranged instructions on how to police their fellow citizens. Their deployment will cost taxpayers more than $130 million, according to Pentagon estimates. The president claims the move was necessary.
I've deployed thousands of National Guard troops and hundreds of Marines to protect federal law enforcement from the attacks of a vicious and violent mob and some of the radical left. They say, oh, that's not nice. Well, if we didn't do it, there wouldn't be a Los Angeles. It'd be burning today.
Trump invoked Title 10, a federal code that allows the president to activate the National Guard if the United States is invaded or in danger of invasion by a foreign nation. If there is a rebellion or danger of a rebellion against the authority of the government of the United States, or if the president is unable with irregular forces to execute the laws of the United States. Newsom and California Attorney General Rob Bonta quickly filed a lawsuit against the Trump administration, alleging the president exceeded his Title 10 authority when he did not consult the governor in deploying the National Guard. On Thursday, U.S. District Judge Charles Breyer agreed that Trump overstepped, writing in his ruling that the federal government cannot be permitted to exceed its bounds and in doing so create the very emergency conditions that it then relies on to justify federal intervention. He directed Trump to return control of the Guard to the California governor by Friday afternoon. But Thursday night, an appeals court blocked his order for 3 days. Though this court battle is far from over, Newsom still praised the ruling.
This decision was important because it's about constraints, it's about limits, it's about our democracy. And that's why we're very grateful by the order.
Other states are now navigating how to quell their own protests. Ahead of major protests in Texas, Governor Greg Abbott deployed 5,000 National Guard soldiers and 2,000 Department of Public Safety troopers across the state.
First of all, we want to make sure that what has happened in California does not happen in Texas. Texas is a law and order state, and we will use every tool that we can to ensure order across our state.
As these demonstrations continue, immigrant communities say they live in fear of ICE raids.
It's very frustrating because there are families that have been here many years without legal status. They come here to work hard. Their children are students who are about to graduate, and they are losing a part of their lives.
Outrage on Thursday when U.S. Senator Alex Padilla, the senior senator from California, was forcibly removed and handcuffed when he tried to ask U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem a question about the immigration raids. Padilla was in the federal building waiting for another meeting when he learned Noem was having a press conference down the hall. As she defended the Trump administration's ramped up immigration raids, Padilla attempted to ask her a question. Within seconds, her security detail surrounded the senator and shoved him out of the room into the hallway. The officers then forced him to the ground and handcuffed him.
If this is how this administration responds to a senator with a question, if this is how the Department of Homeland Security responds to a senator with a question, you can only imagine what they're doing to farm workers, to cooks, to day laborers out in the Los Angeles community and throughout California and throughout the country.
Padilla was not arrested and was released quickly after officers realized they had just handcuffed a U.S. senator. The Department of Homeland Security released a statement saying Padilla had interrupted Noem's press conference with disrespectful political theater. Noem called his behavior inappropriate. Word of the incident spread quickly to Capitol Hill, where Padilla's fellow Democrats expressed outrage, saying his treatment was disgraceful. Archbishop Jose Gomez of the Los Angeles Archdiocese called for both restraint and reform amid the ICE raids and eruption of protests. He also requested all of his parishes hold a special mass for peace and unity on Wednesday. During his homily at a Wednesday mass for the preservation of peace and justice at the Cathedral of Our Lady of the Angels in L.A., Archbishop Gomez told the faithful to bring their concerns and anxieties directly to Jesus.
We're facing a challenging moment in our city, and many of our neighbors are frightened. There is too much tension, too much uncertainty and violence.
Gomez reiterated in his homily, Jesus gave his life for all of us, no matter what countries we come from or the language that we speak. Earlier in the week on Tuesday, Gomez joined other L.A. religious leaders at an interfaith vigil at Grand Park, where thousands were gathered. Following the vigil, the crowd did a peaceful prayer walk through the nearby federal buildings. The neighboring Mexican Bishops Conference also expressed concern amid the wave of ICE raids, writing in a statement, "Not all undocumented migrants are criminals. On the contrary, the vast majority of undocumented migrants contribute to the good of the communities in which they live and work." For a Catholic reaction, we go to a guest who is on the ground in Los Angeles. Father Parker Sandoval is the Vice Chancellor and Senior Director of Ministerial Services for the Archdiocese of Los Angeles. Father, thanks for being with us. Many of us are watching coverage of the California protests from afar, but it's difficult to get a sense of their actual size from these short video clips alone. You are there in L.A. Can you give us your impression of how intense these protests truly are?
Yeah, well, first, thank you for the invitation to join you. And indeed, the city of Los Angeles seems to pass from one crisis to the next these days. And right now, as the country knows, we are in a time of turmoil that is unfolding, sometimes with legitimately peaceful protests, and sometimes, as we see from images in the media too, protests that erupt in violence and destruction. The good news is that the violence and destruction has been concentrated in the heart of downtown Los Angeles, while protests are happening across the city, specifically where ICE may be staying in hotels or in other great public venues. In general, all the activity is concentrated in downtown. So business as usual for most Angelenos, except right in the thick of things downtown.
And Father, the protests are in response to the federal ICE raids taking place in the LA area since early June. In a statement released last week, Archbishop Gomez said the government is carrying out enforcement actions in a way that provokes fear and anxiety among ordinary, hardworking immigrants and their families. Father, can you explain to us the church's concern about how the Trump administration's immigration enforcement raids are being conducted?
Certainly. Of course, the church has great concern for our immigrants because Jesus has great concern for immigrants and, in fact, identifies himself with them. And we see a shift in the last few weeks from the administration. In the past, there was a very clear hierarchy of priorities in terms of those that ICE was targeting for deportation. There seems to be less clarity now, and some of the raids seem to be more random, which of course has created a cloud of fear among many, not only our immigrant community, but many in general, because they fear for their neighbor or they fear for their coworker. And so many people are indeed staying home. We see lighter traffic in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, this means people are staying home from Sunday Mass as well. We are blessed in Los Angeles with many faithful immigrants who populate many of our parishes, and they're gripped with fear at this moment because of the unknown and the perception of greater risk. So, of course, we are very concerned for their spiritual life, and we're concerned that they be treated with great dignity and respect owed to any person.
And on that note, I think some important perspective, the LA Archdiocese is the largest diocese in the nation, serving nearly 4.5 million Catholics, I believe, with the Mass celebrated in 42 different languages. Father, talk more about the diversity of the church in Los Angeles and the role our brothers and sisters who immigrated have there.
Indeed, the Archdiocese of Los Angeles is a microcosm of the universal church. Everyone is here. And the great gift is that cultural expressions of faith in our Lord come to the fore, whether in liturgy or the devotional life of our parishes. So indeed, the rich diversity of the family of God is always on display here. But above all, our unity in the Lord is always on display here. And I for one, was assigned to an immigrant parish in the inner city, and the parish comprised immigrants and their children. And every day I saw faith greater than mine in them. And so they add such greatness to the church here in Los Angeles. And we can learn so much from their dependence on God. They really are part of the fabric of the church here in Los Angeles.
Father, Archbishop Gomez is calling on Congress to fix an immigration system that leads so many to seek to cross our borders illegally. Talk to us about how the church both accompanies those who immigrated, including illegally, while also advocating for immigration reform. Do those two things have to be diametrically opposed, as our media and politics so often will have us believe?
No, certainly not. And of course, we know the church teaches both, that people have a natural right to migrate when they cannot find dignified work in their homeland. And at the same time, the church teaches that a state has the right to control its borders for the common good while respecting the rights of individuals. And as you say, those are not in competition. The church says yes to both. And that really is the hard part. Our task is to propose the truth flowing from the gospel as found in the scripture and tradition. And our task, too, is to accompany people on the ground as our politicians work towards specific policies to address this issue. And of course, the principal thing as a church we do is we wrap our people, especially those suffering, in prayer. I cannot tell you the number of parishes who have reported to me in the last days that they have started novenas to pray for all those gripped in fear, whether because of violence or because of the fear of being separated from their families. Archbishop celebrated a special mass to call for peace and unity among all people of goodwill. So this is part and parcel of the life of the church here in Los Angeles right now.
Well, on that note of peace and unity, Father, do you think it's possible that these protests happening in L.A. can be done peacefully? And in your opinion, why is it important that they are?
Yeah, indeed, I've seen right across the street from the parish where I live the last several nights, there have been very peaceful protests. Of course, I've also been in downtown Los Angeles and have seen the results of less than peaceful protests. And of course, the voice of the church always resounds with the truth that violence and destruction are never a way to foster justice. In fact, only creates further division and discord. And as much as we enjoy the incredible blessing of religious freedom here, we also enjoy the incredible blessing to assemble in public and to show our witness for those who are suffering in any way. So yes, indeed, the church encourages only peaceful protests, and anything that even remotely resembles a riot, we absolutely reject and call people to recognize this is not a way forward.
Father, I have about 30 seconds left with you, but I do want to ask you this. The National Eucharistic Pilgrimage is set to conclude in LA next week. Is that still the plan, given the protests?
That is the plan, and in some way, Eucharistic revival naturally leads to a revival in faith in Jesus in the face of the suffering. And so, indeed, we need to gather in prayer. The schedule and the programming may adjust slightly because safety is the number one priority. But the pilgrims are coming, and we will conclude the National Eucharistic Revival here next weekend.
Father Sandoval, thank you so much for your perspective and time. Thank you.
Thank you.
There is so much more going on of interest in the Catholic space this week. EWTN News in Depth is just getting started.
It was super exciting to come to my hometown. I've had this date circled on the calendar ever since we started pilgrimage.
It gets personal for one perpetual pilgrim when the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage pulls into a Texas town. That story ahead.
We're here in the south suburbs of Chicago at the childhood home of the first American Pope. We're going to go on inside. Let's check it out.
And on the auction block, days before it is sold, we get a tour of the house where Leo lived. EWTN News in Depth is coming right back.
First American Pope. Grew up right here in Dalton.
Yes.
Pretty amazing.
It's awesome. I think it's awesome.
A major American city and its southern suburb with something big to celebrate. It's Pope Leo weekend in Chicago, all because of the life of a little boy in this house in suburban Dalton. The boy who grew up to become the first pope from the United States. The city of Chicago celebrates Pope Leo this weekend at a big party in his honor at Raitt Field, home of his favorite baseball team, the Chicago White Sox. That's where the Archdiocese of Chicago will welcome thousands to participate in a celebration on Saturday of the Son of Chicago, with tributes, testimonials, music, and a video message from Pope Leo himself. It will conclude with an open-air mass in the stadium to pray for peace and unity and an opportunity to celebrate with joy this Chicago moment. In the meantime, this coming Wednesday marks the closing of a real estate auction to sell Pope Leo's childhood home. The modest brick house was already listed for sale at $199,000 when Robert Francis Prevost became Pope in early May. After that, inundated by offers, the owner took it off the market, regrouped, and put it up for auction with a minimum bid of $250,000. Our own real estate sleuth reporter Mark Irons tells us the price will skyrocket from there. Mark gives us a little sneak peek of the property.
Welcome to 212 East 141st Place. It's the modest three-bedroom brick home in Dalton, Illinois, with a red door, rosary around the knob, and people in the yard eager to look around. These guys came from Poland to see where the first American Pope came from.
We're in the south suburbs of Chicago, where Pope Leo XIV grew up, and we're right here at his childhood home. Let's take a look inside.
Before this moment, this was just another house on a simple street. Now it's become something of a pilgrimage site.
Well, I'm Catholic and I'm really happy about him.
People like Oscar stopped by. He said he had to drive over during a break from work.
This is actually an honor to do this. It's an honor just to be here.
And Officer LaTanya Ruffin is stationed here to keep watch of a property growing in popularity as affection grows for the Pope.
People coming out and they love him. They love this man.
Meanwhile, a contractor with tools and paint in hand goes inside to touch up the place. After all, this home is up for sale to be auctioned off. Anonymous online bidding has already begun. The auction ends June 18th.
La pace sia con tutti voi.
As the world was introduced to Pope Leo XIV for the first time, his childhood home was listed for sale for less than $250,000. But the current owner, not related to the Pope, realized interest in this place would soon increase. We got on the phone with the owner's agent, realtor Steve Budzik.
I can tell you this, I've talked to a lot of people every time I'm at the property, and everybody has pretty much told me that they think it'll sell for over $1 million.
Whatever the price, the past might make it all worth it for prospective buyers. The major selling point here is history.
Just think, the first American Pope, when he was a boy, would have walked up these very stairs to go to his room, maybe to do his math homework, or play with his two brothers, or to say his prayers before he went to bed.
For Chicago Catholics like Peter Comish, this is all pretty exciting.
What does it mean for you to know the first American Pope is from here in Chicago?
I'm proud. I'm very proud of it, you know, and happy that, you know, hopefully maybe Pope will come to Chicago.
His friends from Poland had already planned to come for a visit, but when they found out about 212 East 141st Place, they added it to their itinerary.
He saw the election of Pope on TV, you know, and already that trip was planned, to be honest, but the first phone call I have, will you take me to Pope's home? You know, I said, of course.
The question is, what will this house become?
And I think by them making it as a museum would be very nice for Dalton.
The village of Dalton is interested in turning it into a historic site. According to Budzik, the Archdiocese of Chicago is working with the village as well. Dalton officials say they could acquire the property by eminent domain if auction negotiations fall through. For now, we can only speculate about who will win the small home with the red door that represents a big first in church history.
Is the Vatican interested?
Again, no comment.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in Depth.
We are excited to learn the outcome of the house auction. Join us next week at this time when we tell you what we've learned about that special buyer. As for this weekend's Pope Leo celebration at the baseball stadium, one White Sox fan who is celebrating Pope Leo sat beside the priest he knew as Father Bob at the 2005 World Series. Father Bob was a close friend of his grandfather's and was his guest at the game. The fan was just 5 years old at the time.
Our family's been diehard White Sox fans before I was born. We've had the same seats, same section for the World Series that we have them now. So we were there at the ballpark when they put up that mural, I guess you could say. And that's me sitting right next to him at the World Series. It's pretty incredible to see that. Because I still go to games as often as I possibly can. And to see that up there with that picture of me, my dad, and the Pope, it's incredible. Because I'll always, you know, be like, if that was me.
Schmidt says his entire family thinks Pope Leo is a, quote, unbelievable guy who will do amazing things for the world. The Vatican announced Friday both Blessed Carlo Acutis and Blessed Pier Giorgio Frassati, two young Catholics beloved for their vibrant faith, will be canonized together on September 7th. Acutis' canonization was originally scheduled for April 27th, but was postponed following the death of Pope Francis. Friday's Vatican announcement reveals an unexpected move because now Frassati's canonization date is also being moved from its original August 3rd date. The September canonization mass is expected to take place in St. Peter's Square. We turn now to several major news stories. Israel launches military strikes against Iran's nuclear program. A major airplane crash in India kills nearly 300 and more. The Week in Review is next. Israel has launched a preemptive airstrike on Iran's nuclear program. That wide-ranging attack tops the Week in Review. The surprise airstrike on Tehran was the biggest in years and opens a new chapter of conflict in the Middle East. Smoke could be seen rising over Tehran on Friday morning as Israel launched its Operation Rising Lion. More than 200 Israeli warplanes dropped hundreds of bombs across Iran, targeting ballistic missile sites, its top three acting commanders, and the nuclear enrichment facility where it produces a majority of its nuclear fuel. Israeli leaders say the attacks are an effort to defend their country from Iran's growing nuclear program. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu vowed the attacks will continue for as many days as it takes.
If not stopped, Iran could produce a nuclear weapon in a very short time. It could be a year. It could be within a few months, less than a year. This is a clear and present danger to Israel's very survival.
Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei warned Israel it should expect severe punishment for the attack. This attack comes days before a sixth round of nuclear talks between the U.S. and Iran. Iran has now backed out. These diplomatic discussions have long been at an impasse. For analysis of the broader implications of Israel's strike on Iran, we turn to Middle East expert, EWTN News contributor, and former State Department ambassador, Alberto Fernandez. Alberto, thanks for being here. First, what is your reaction to the scale of this attack?
Well, it's looking at it militarily and intelligence-wise, it's an astonishing thing to see, an astonishing success. Just the level of expertise and the level of punishment that Israel has been able to inflict on the Iranian regime.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio said the U.S. was not involved in this attack. On Friday, President Trump urged Iran to make a nuclear deal before there is nothing left, suggesting any subsequent attacks would be even more brutal. What's your sense of whether the U.S. will be able to disentangle and distance itself from this conflict in the Middle East?
Well, the good news is so far the U.S. is disentangled in the sense that the U.S. is not a belligerent. Iran had always said that if such a thing happened, they would attack the United States or attack American bases, and that hasn't happened. I think what the administration is doing and what you see in the words of the president and the secretary are very smart. Mm-hmm. What they're doing is giving Iran the image or the possibility of some kind of off-ramp, mm-hmm. of some kind of way out. At some point in the future, we don't know exactly how much, days, weeks, hours, we can't say, but saying that there's a way after, that there's a way out, that something, some deal, some arrangement can be arrived mm-hmm. at.
Do you think a nuclear deal is likely at this point, and how critical are those talks?
I don't think the discussion that was had before these attacks and now is going to be very different. So, of course, there's still a lot to discuss about Iran, about security, about nuclear weapons and stuff like that. But the tempo and the nature of the discussion will be radically different than it was 24 hours ago.
Alberto, were you surprised by how unprepared Iran seemed to have been for this attack?
I was. We hear about the elaborate Israeli efforts at deception. But one would have thought that even if the Israelis were very successful in their deception, the Iranians would have been on high alert. After all, they've been waging war against Israel for decades, but in the latest round, at least for months. I think part of the problem is we think of this regime in Iran as this colossus. But of course, it's a regime also which fights amongst itself and has rivalries and bitter conflict within the regime itself.
How do you expect Iran will retaliate?
Iran must retaliate. Obviously, they already tried and it didn't work. They fired some initial drones and they failed. They will continue to try to do so and to hit Israel as hard as they can. The question, of course, is their capabilities. And even if they are successful, of course, then what will be Israeli counter responses against Iran?
And Alberto, finally, in our last minute together, what are you going to be watching out for in these coming days?
I'm going to be watching for signals of escalation and de-escalation. One of them I just mentioned, the Iranian response to the Israelis. The Israelis can also escalate. They can target political targets like the political leadership. They can target oil facilities as well. And I will be looking for questions or possibilities of de-escalation, the American role, and anything that would lead either the Israelis or the Iranians to say, okay, we accomplished our goals. We're going to take a pause and see what happens next. Mm.
We are grateful for your expertise on this developing story. Alberto Fernandez, thank you so much.
Thank you.
A devastating plane crash in India has claimed the lives of more than 240 people, making it one of India's worst airline disasters in decades. The Boeing 787 had just taken off from the Ahmedabad airport in western India on Thursday afternoon when it suddenly lost signal and plummeted into a medical college, bursting into flames. Smoke could be seen billowing from the site of impact. The crash killed 12 crew members, 229 passengers, and more than two dozen on the ground. A sole passenger miraculously survived. This is the first crash ever of a Boeing 787 Dreamliner. An international investigation is trying to determine exactly what caused the fatal crash.
There's so many elements within ultimately the ecosystem that is aviation. You have the airline, you have the aircraft, you have air traffic control, airport operations, and Mother Nature at work. So all of this needs to be understood because it could be one element within that entire mix that imbalance the entire ability for the aircraft to be able to depart safely.
Rescue efforts continued into Friday as crews combed through the debris in search of more victims. Shortly after the crash, Pope Leo XIV expressed his condolences and prayers for those lost. The Catholic Bishops' Conference of India said the heartbreaking incident left its nation in shock and in mourning. In a statement, it urged all our Catholic faithful and all people of goodwill across the country to join us in prayer for the victims of this tragedy, for the eternal rest of those who have died, and for comfort to the bereaved. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. named 8 new doctors and researchers to the CDC's vaccine advisory panel. This just a couple of days after his shocking removal of all 17 of the panel's experts, a move he said was a long time coming. RFK Jr.'s replacement of 17 world-renowned immunization experts is unprecedented. Members are typically vetted by career agency officials and serve 4-year terms. All 8 of the secretary's new picks are either medical doctors or have doctorates, though some have been criticized for being skeptical of vaccines. In replacing the panel, he said he was addressing financial and political conflicts of interest and wanted to regain the public's trust in vaccines. But the former experts on the panel say their departure means a major loss of institutional knowledge.
I have a concern that we need to have really outstanding people on that committee. The 17 people who were just removed are some of the best scientists in the world. It's an extraordinary amount of expertise, and replacing that on the drop of a hat is going to be hard to do.
This panel plays an influential role in shaping national vaccine policy. The new members will meet later this month to review guidance on COVID-19 and HPV vaccines. A bill that would legalize assisted suicide in New York State moved one step closer to becoming law on Monday after a Democratic-controlled Senate advanced the bill by a vote of 35-27. The legislation would allow a person to be prescribed life-ending drugs if they have an incurable and irreversible illness that will result in death within 6 months. 2 doctors must sign off on the prescription, as well as 2 witnesses, to ensure the patient is not being coerced. While some senators have praised the bill for its supposed focus on death with dignity, opponents say those safeguards are not enough.
It isn't about controlling the disease or controlling the pain. It's about having control at the end of your life. Our medical profession has prolonged our lives, prolonged our deaths, and people want some form of control.
Who is this assisted suicide bill really helping? And who is it quietly abandoning? I'll tell you. It's abandoning the vulnerable, our seniors, those living with disabilities, and those in their darkest moments.
The legislation is now headed to Governor Kathy Hochul's desk. If she signs the bill, New York will join 11 other states and the District of Columbia with similar laws. A leading New York Catholic voice against the assisted suicide bill joins us now from Albany. Dennis Paust is executive director of the New York State Catholic Conference. Dennis, thanks for being with us. Assisted suicide is legal in a dozen U.S. jurisdictions already. But what makes this New York bill especially egregious if passed?
Well, I'd argue that they're all especially egregious, but like New York likes to be the best or the worst in everything. And this is clearly the worst assisted suicide bill in the country. One reason is, unlike every other bill that has passed, there is no waiting period at all. So you could get a terminal diagnosis from your doctor. You'll be grief-stricken. You'll be in despair. And you could, at that moment, request assisted suicide drugs from that doctor and then from a subsequent doctor next door. And the next day, you could be ending your life. It's egregious. And what's more, there's no absolutely no requirement even for a psychological evaluation. Everyone who gets a terminal diagnosis has a moment of depression. We all know the 5 stages of grief, and depression is one of them. But the doctors don't have to even go there. They could just prescribe the pills if you're of sound mind.
And of course, a diagnosis is not final. God is in control after all. Dennis, the bill is headed to Governor Hochul's desk. Governor Hochul is Catholic. Has the New York State Catholic Conference or any of the bishops of New York spoken to the governor about this bill?
Well, we intend to, you know, we have been in communication with her office. And, you know, I know that Cardinal Dolan did have some brief words with her in person, just at a parade. It wasn't anything formal. We anticipate speaking directly to the governor and her staff, but not really making so much a religious Catholic argument. This bill is just bad public policy. It's bad for people with disabilities, vulnerable people, people of color who tend to live in medically underserved areas and already get sort of cheated in the healthcare system. So there are a lot of good reasons for the governor to veto this that have really nothing to do with her Catholic faith.
Dennis, proponents of the bill say this is about bodily autonomy. What's your response to that?
Well, you know, Catherine, to that I would say, you know, this bill is about taking people whose bodily autonomy has failed them and killing them. So it's the furthest thing from bodily autonomy. It's kind of the opposite. We're saying that you no longer have utility if you are disabled or sick. You know, people who are ill lose bodily autonomy, and that's when people request suicide drugs. We've heard in Oregon and other states that is the most important thing, that the first thing that they cite: loss of independence, loss of bodily autonomy. So we need to really work with people to understand that they don't lose their human dignity when they lose their autonomy, when they lose their ability to control their bodies the way they used to when they were younger.
Were you surprised that New York passed this bill, especially in light of what we're seeing coming out of Canada right now? Canada's medical assistance and dying program is now the fifth leading cause of death. Shouldn't New York lawmakers be concerned of that same pattern potentially happening here?
Absolutely. And Canada is our neighbor, you know, and we border Canada. The governor's home city of Buffalo borders Canada. And I have to admit, I was surprised. And it's my job to not be surprised at things that move in the legislature. But I really didn't think they would go there. I didn't think that they had the votes for the longest time, and they didn't. So we're trying to figure out like what changed. But I can say that a lot of Democrats who control both houses of the legislature have very serious problems with it. 21 Democrats in the state assembly voted against it, most of them people of color. Six Democrats in the Senate voted against it out of 41 Democrats in that chamber. So there's significant pushback even among Democrats. And Governor Hochul, I would hope, would see that and say, wait, this isn't so much a partisan issue. This isn't so clear cut.
Dennis, considering the topic that we are discussing, do you have a message for anyone who may be considering physician-assisted suicide themselves?
Yeah, well, first of all, we hope it doesn't come to that in New York, but I know your reach is national. And I would say that we understand the fear, and no one wants you to suffer. And the last thing I ever do is talk about things like the redemptive power of suffering. I'm not a theologian, right? We don't want anyone to suffer. We want people to avail themselves of hospice care. There are ways to control pain. There are ways to pass from this life to the next in peace and love and with caring people around you. I would strongly urge people to not despair and to let God take you when he's good and ready.
Dennis, be assured of our prayers for New Yorkers and for you and your work. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Catherine. I really appreciate you letting me spread the word.
Absolutely. Thank you. A massive military parade is taking place in Washington, D.C. on Saturday to commemorate the 250th anniversary of the U.S. Army. The parade also just happens to coincide with President Trump's 79th birthday. The president has long expressed a desire to hold a parade in the nation's capital to showcase America's military might. More than 6,500 soldiers have been brought in from around the country to take part in the festivities. Featured military hardware will include about 50 aircraft and 150 vehicles, including tanks and heavy weaponry. There will be fireworks, flyovers, military demonstrations, and country music. At a time when Congress and DOGE are taking a hard look at budget cuts, the event is projected to cost as much as $45 million. to potentially include millions to repair D.C. streets from damage caused by heavy armored vehicles. President Trump said last month the cost is, quote, peanuts compared to the value of the celebration.
It's just before rush hour here in downtown Dallas, where hundreds have showed up to fill the streets to process with our Lord as the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage reaches Texas. I'm Julia Convery, and we have that story coming up.
We are back on the pilgrimage trail in both Oklahoma and Texas. The highlights, from the Stanley Rother Shrine to a Byzantine church in North Texas to the Cathedral of Our Lady of Guadalupe in Dallas. Next.
Like we're driving along, you know, somebody just like, where are we going? And everybody just shouts out, heaven!
A Franciscan friar traveling on the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage route describes the excited reaction as perpetual pilgrims and their chaplains travel across the United States with a monstrance containing the Eucharist, the true presence of Christ our Lord. The 2025 pilgrimage is headed towards a conclusion this upcoming weekend in Los Angeles as we near the end of the three-year National Eucharistic Revival, the Catholic Church's grassroots response to be reunited around the source and summit of our faith in the celebration of the Eucharist. From Indianapolis in mid-May to Los Angeles in mid-June, the four-week Drexel route winds through 10 states, more than 3,000 miles in length. A group of eight perpetual pilgrims is traveling the entire route, with local Catholics joining in at individual locations. Julia Convery reports from Oklahoma and the midway point in Texas.
Hundreds of pilgrims knelt before the Most Holy Sacrament as he was lifted up from the top of Tepeyac Hill, overlooking the Blessed Stanley Rother Shrine in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, the halfway point of the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage.
I think to have the Blessed Sacrament on top of the Tepeyac Hill was, I think, a breathtaking experience. It really was.
Oklahoma is home to the first beatified U.S.-born priest and martyr, Blessed Stanley Rother, and his body is revered at the Blessed Stanley Rother Shrine in Oklahoma City.
Blessed Stanley had a great devotion to the Eucharist, and we're very honored to have the opportunity to promote his cause and to lift him up and introduce him to more and more of the faithful. So this is a great place to do that.
Pilgrims came from out of state to not only visit the Blessed's tomb, but to process with our Lord around the campus grounds, touched at the opportunity to witness the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage.
It was a beautiful procession, and it's something we need to show our faith in.
It's just such a blessing to have the Eucharistic Pilgrimage coming through our diocese.
That's why we're here, to process, to make sure that everyone knows that only He can save us.
We caught up with one pilgrim, Maria Fund, who embraced the nomadic nature of the pilgrimage, following the route from Illinois. By relying on God's providence, she found generous hosts to provide transportation and shelter along the way.
Also, I have enjoyed meeting the body of Christ in the people of the different places.
Meanwhile, one of the perpetual pilgrims was happy for a brief respite from the pilgrim lifestyle, arriving in his hometown of Sherman, Texas.
You feel like a pilgrim, but here I kind of feel at home, you know, like I belong, like I fit in. And that just, you know, getting a hug from your parents when you've been on the road for 2 weeks is really just like a place of comfort and a place of security.
What a blessing it is to have Charlie here, back in his home parish, by the way. He was baptized right here in this church right across the street. And I've known Charlie for about 10 years as he grew up, and it's just a big coincidence to see him 10 years later, all grown up and an adult.
The parish he was baptized in also happens to be one of the four designated Jubilee sites in the Diocese of Dallas, with specially commissioned holy doors, modeled after St. Peter's Basilica at the Vatican.
From Oklahoma City to downtown Dallas, the Drexel route is crossing not only state lines, but cultural lines as well, visiting parishes like this Byzantine Catholic Church, and later on the largely Hispanic National Shrine Cathedral of Our Lady of Guadalupe.
Pilgrims packed the small Byzantine church that Wednesday afternoon,
eager to share in a liturgy that was new to some, leaving an impact on their hearts.
We're so blessed in the Catholic Church that our Lord in his creativity really allows all these beautiful ways to worship, but yet we're still one in the Eucharist.
It's so exciting seeing it come through Dallas. I mean, we saw so much news coverage of the previous Eucharistic pilgrimages, and to see it actually come through here.
The next stop was just outside of downtown Dallas, where the Hispanic community showed up in droves to welcome the pilgrimage, building a special float to process with the Blessed Sacrament. The evening procession was followed by an early morning one, people showing up at 6 in the morning, just before rush hour traffic would hit the streets of downtown Dallas.
We wanted a chance to bring our whole family together and walk through our city with Jesus to help bless our city and bring Jesus closer to the people of our city.
We came because the Eucharist is where we receive all of our strength to be on mission.
I'm just so blessed to have this experience, to be able to trod the streets with Jesus.
The bells tolled, marking Christ's arrival to the National Shrine Cathedral of Our Lady of Guadalupe, the last stop in the Diocese of Dallas. With the end of the pilgrimage in sight, perpetual pilgrims share their hopes for the remainder of their time on the road.
What am I excited about? I'm really excited to get to LA. We have a really big procession planned. Really excited to just like bring Jesus back to the margins and make space for people to encounter him.
3 weeks from now, I don't know what the Lord's gonna do. I just know like the Holy Spirit like wants to continue to just dive deeper into my heart and just like encounter the people on the streets that we pass.
So I think the hope is not only that people would join in the processions on this pilgrimage, but that they would join the church on the pilgrimage which she is on towards heaven.
In Dallas, Julia Convery, EWTN News in Depth.
The national pilgrimage is not over. There are more stops to come before pilgrims reach their destination in Los Angeles. You can find out more about the upcoming stopovers at eucharisticpilgrimage.org.
Being raised with a single mother is kind of hard on the children, not only the mother, but the children, because my mom worked so hard to get us into the education we needed.
Looking out for young boys who might otherwise not get the schooling they need. When we come back, we'll go inside a unique Catholic middle school designed to give those boys the boost to achieve their dreams. This week marked the last day of the school year at a very special place of learning in Washington, D.C. The Catholic San Miguel Middle School was created to meet the needs of a group of students who often don't make it the whole way through high school, much less go on to college. Reporter Roselle Regis tells us about San Miguel's unique mission.
It started in a basement of a church years ago to provide quality education to underserved communities. With only 6 students enrolled, sitting on the outskirts of Washington, D.C., this is San Miguel School now.
San Miguel was started in 2002 by Brother Thomas Giroux at St. John's College High School. And he wanted to start a school specifically for the group of students who were the least likely to graduate high school in Washington, D.C., and that was Latino males.
According to Washington, D.C. high school graduation rate data, students of Hispanic Latino heritage have the lowest graduation rate among all demographic groups at 70%. And that percentage drops even more when taking household income and gender into account.
The statistics for economically disadvantaged Latino males only have a 49% high school graduation rate.
The Brothers of Christian Schools, also known as the De La Salle Christian Brothers, recognize that high-quality education is often out of reach for many Latino children. As a Catholic religious order of men dedicated exclusively to the ministry of education, they decided to establish San Miguel Middle School. San Miguel is tuition-free, serving nearly 100 students from grades 6 to 8, 9% of whom come from low-income households and arrive 2 to 3 years behind grade level.
We don't have to worry about, like, stress and about other people, how other people think about us when we're all just one group and we're all like brothers.
When Brandy Reyes started sixth grade, he was behind academically due to the pandemic and was acting out in class. Reyes, who has graduated and is a current student in St. John's College High School, said attending San Miguel has changed his life.
Coming from a family that really didn't like graduate from high school, my mother didn't finish school, my brothers, they haven't finished high school yet. So for me, it's like, it's a great opportunity to, you know, stay in high school and finish to prove to my family that I can do it.
Students have a 9-hour school day with an extended school year, daily study hall, and small classes. The school also integrates Catholic faith formation throughout students' daily lives, cultivating what they call Miguel men. Diana Aguilar, art and religion teacher, explained that students learn about LaSallian principles to help with their spiritual growth.
There are 12 LaSallian virtues, which are the same of the gospel, you know, being generous and being also showing humility and reserve and patience and silence and zeal. So the boys will tell you all about those. Every Thursday we come together as a community and we talk about the virtue of the week. And we also talk about how to live by that virtue.
With many students whose families trace their roots to Central and South America, the school also pays tribute to their namesake, San Miguel Febres Cordero, Ecuador's first male saint canonized in 1984. As an immigrant from El Salvador, Aguilar has a great connection to the students.
They think it's an opportunity to give back to the community and also to empower the boys that they can be anything that they want to become. And it's just nice to see them grow because we don't stop at just the middle school. We follow them into high school and then college.
Nationwide, Latinos have the lowest college enrollment rate of any reported demographic group, 30%. San Miguel hopes to change that with a graduate support program, following the boys through high school and college. Like William, a current eighth grader who will be moving on to high school in a few months.
Right now, since I'm going to Gonzaga College High School, that's where I'm going to be attending. So I really want to like succeed as like, much as possible, like straight A's every single year. Be involved in as many clubs as I can, try new sports. Because I want to go to an Ivy League school, so I definitely have to work a lot, very hard for that.
According to San Miguel's 2023 to 2024 report, 90% of graduates are college-bound this year, with a vast majority heading to four-year institutions. With the many success stories from graduates, San Miguel School hopes to expand in the future to serve more communities in need in the D.C. area. Rosal Regis, EWTN News in Depth.
So inspiring. And that's this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. We hope you'll be back same time next week for more news and reports important to your Catholic life. Until we see you again, God bless.